Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Bartlett Naylor, financial policy advocate with Public Citizen, who discusses the danger he sees in the Trump GOP drive to deregulate the U.S. banking system, including the current effort to weaken the Volcker Rule. Frederick Clarkson of Political Research Associates, who discusses the little-known Project Blitz he exposed that's advocating the adoption of a Christian nationalist agenda in state legislatures across the U.S. And sixth-grade student Sam Rosenberg and climate activist Diane Lentekis, who speak at a rally for Our Climate Future that Sam organized, urging everyone to lower their carbon footprint and press their legislators to take action. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
A year after the Columbia Peace Accord took hold, voters face a presidential election pitting hardline conservative Ivan Duque against former leftist guerrilla and previous mayor of Bogota, Gustavo Petro, who is running as a progressive populist. Outgoing President Juan Manuel Santos, who negotiated the historic peace deal with the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, or FARC, is leaving office with little support. The peace deal would be dramatically weakened if Duque wins the election on June 17th. Duque, the hardline conservative linked to opponents of the peace deal, won the first round of the presidential election with 39% of the vote. Petro, a former member of the M19 guerrilla movement, is popular in Bogota's slums and promises a humane Colombia with improved health care and education and an anti-corruption offensive. Duque is an ally of former President Álvaro Uribe, who is associated with right-wing paramilitary groups. According to the Guardian newspaper, 160 land reform and indigenous leaders have been killed in recent months amid growing violence between the Colombian army and criminal gangs over control of the lucrative coca crop. 7 years after the people of Tunisia launched the Arab Spring uprising, unemployed and marginalized youth remain frustrated and angry at their nation's economic stagnation. Meanwhile, mass migration into cities has swelled the population of makeshift settlements surrounding the capital city of Tunis. On the outskirts of Tunis, the Dawar Isher settlement, known as Tunisia's own Paris suburbs, is filled with angry youth who are regularly engaged in conflicts with police. It was in these neighborhoods that the Arab Spring was born, in opposition to the government's economic policy of raising the prices on basic goods. Activist Usama Marasi told the Christian Science Monitor, "Our problem isn't politics, it's unemployment and marginalization." Still, growing numbers of frustrated youth fill the streets of Tunisia's working-class neighborhoods, where the unemployment rate is nearly 50%. Ramdani Ben Amour of the Tunisia Forum for Economic and Social Rights warns, "These communities are socioeconomic time bombs." Even as congressional Republicans continue their drive to repeal Obamacare, Virginia joins 32 other states who have already expanded Medicaid coverage. Months after Democrats made dramatic gains in the Virginia legislature, a handful of Republican state senators crossed party lines to vote for the Medicaid expansion, benefiting the working poor in this purple southern state. Expanding Medicaid is a major victory for Governor Ralph Northam, and it will provide health insurance coverage to 400,000 more Virginians. In a deal to break a deadlock over the state budget, enough Republicans voted to expand Medicaid health coverage, which will now pump $2 billion federal dollars into Virginia's Medicaid program. Ironically, Trump-era reforms, including allowing states to impose a work requirement for Medicaid recipients, increased conservative support for Medicaid expansion. This fall, several Republican-controlled states, including Idaho and Nebraska, will vote on expanding Medicaid. Once Medicaid expansion is implemented in January, Virginia will be transformed from operating one of the most restrictive Medicaid programs in the nation to providing health insurance to all people with incomes of up to 138% of the federal poverty level. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Richard Hill.
It's been 10 years since the U.S. and global economy suffered the worst decline since the Great Depression. The 2008 meltdown of the financial system provoked Congress to pass banking reform legislation under the name Dodd-Frank, which sought to decrease Wall Street's risky behavior and increase oversight. But from the day it was signed into law in 2010, Republicans have vowed to weaken or eliminate these financial regulations. With Donald Trump in the White House and support from Wall Street and some Democratic lawmakers, the GOP has made good on that pledge. After passage in the House and Senate, Trump signed legislation on May 24th that exempts some small and regional banks from the most stringent Dodd-Frank regulations, while also loosening rules designed to prevent the future collapse of the nation's biggest banks. Trump and the Republicans have now launched an initiative to water down another post-financial crisis regulation, the Volcker Rule, put in place to stop banks from making risky bets with depositors' money. The Federal Reserve, along with four other federal agencies, have proposed changes to undermine the Volcker Rule. The rule, named for former Federal Reserve Chair Paul Volcker, has been criticized by Wall Street as both burdensome and harmful. Your reporter spoke with Bartlett Naylor, financial policy advocate with Public Citizen, who discusses the danger he sees in the weakening of the Volcker Rule and the Trump GOP deregulation of the U.S. banking system.
Paul Volcker had this simple idea that everyone, including bankers, agree with, that you shouldn't take government-backed, taxpayer-backed deposits, which are cheap and abundant, how much do you get paid on your checking account, and use them for speculation. They should be used in a bank for making patient loans to businesses and consumers. And he had that idea following the financial crisis where a bunch of these speculative bets exploded into the cataclysm that we know as the 2008 financial crisis, and it became the Volcker Rule.
I think it would be useful to talk about how the Volcker Rule fits in with the overall Dodd-Frank banking regulations that came into force years after the 2008 financial crisis and rules that have since now, under the Republican Congress and under President Trump, have been diluted to a great extent. But tell us about the key role of the Volcker Rule during the post-crisis years.
The 2010 Dodd-Frank law has about 400 separate rules in them. Most conspicuous are the rules contained in Title 10, which create the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. There are many reasons to cause the housing bubble and crash, but one of them was unbridled predatory lending. And so was created an entirely new agency, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, to protect against predatory lending that essentially led to this housing bubble. Within the other parts of the law were issues addressing systemic risk, that is to say, banks were engaged in reckless activities, one of which was speculation, using the bank's own money to make bets on a variety of things, obtuse, complex derivatives, purchasing credit default swaps. Today we talk about Bitcoin and so forth. And in response to that, Section 619, the Volcker Rule, is one of those 400 rules that Congress enacted. And while it's only, I would say, 600 words long in statute, the first rule that was finalized in 2013 absorbs more than 1,000 pages double space. And it's that 2013 rule that's being replaced by this current proposal.
Bartlett,
wanted to ask you what the danger is here. I've read summaries of the proposal to change the Volcker Rule, and it looks like they're attempting to break up financial institutions and banks into two groups, large banks and small and medium banks, and saying that the Volcker Rule will still apply to the larger banks, but they're going to loosen restrictions on investments and speculation with the small and medium banks. What's the danger here in your view?
J.P. Morgan lost $5 or so billion a few years in what's summarized as the London whale episode, claiming it was a hedge. In fact, it was a directional bet. And when the market learned about that and learned, in fact, the CEO's inability to understand it, they discounted J.P. Morgan's stock by nearly 30%. That's the danger, that these bets can go wrong. And one must understand that banks are highly leveraged. That is to say, for whatever they do, they're borrowing most of the money to do it. In other words, for every $100 that J.P. Morgan has put out in a loan, it borrowed $95 to do that. So if somehow that loan or that effort by J.P. Morgan is 5% off, J.P. Morgan or that bank is insolvent. Loans don't go bad quickly. One, you know, if your sales are off in the factory that you've built with borrowed money, that often happens slowly. But a bet can go bad badly. And so with speculation, if you lose a bet, you can wipe out the bank's capital. That is the difference between assets and liabilities. And so the Volcker Rule is meant not only to protect the taxpayer subsidy for gambling, it's meant to protect the system and from bailouts generally. Not only do we need to have a strong Volcker Rule, not a diluted Volcker Rule, we really need to separate banks into completely different types of business. If you're going to have FDIC insurance, you should be completely limited in what you do with that to making business loans and consumer loans. If you want to speculate, if you want to make bets on Bitcoin or engage in derivatives, you should be something completely different, an investment bank. Get your money from other investors, borrow it from the bond market. This is known as restoring Glass-Steagall. This is the 1933 deal that both established FDIC insurance and separated commercial and investment banking. That was repealed by regulatory fiat and formally in 1999, and it was less than a decade later that we had the eruption in 2008. That's what's really needed. The Volcker Rule is an important step, but rather than watering it down, Congress really needs to pass Glass-Steagall. And interestingly enough, that was provided in the platforms of both the Democratic Party and the Republican Party. Unfortunately, Trump has proved that he is going in a very different direction.
That was Bartlett Naylor, financial policy advocate with Public Citizen. Learn more about the Trump GOP drive to deregulate the U.S. banking system by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Conservative Christian evangelicals have been an important part of the Republican Party coalition since 1980, when Ronald Reagan unexpectedly defeated Jimmy Carter in the presidential election that year. For nearly 40 years, the Christian right has held a critical seat at the table when the GOP formulates its policy positions on a wide range of social issues, including same-sex marriage, abortion, and transgender bathroom assignments. According to exit polls, some 81% of Christian evangelicals voted for Donald Trump in 2016, and a recent Public Religion Research Institute poll conducted in March found that 75% of white evangelicals surveyed still had a positive opinion of the president. Since 2016, Republicans control all branches of the federal government. They're in charge of 32 state legislatures and hold all levers of power in 26 states that also elected GOP governors. With Republicans' current lopsided hold on political power across the nation, the Christian right is very much aware of this unique moment in political history and heavily focused on winning legislative battles while they can. Your reporter spoke with Frederick Clarkson, a senior fellow with Political Research Associates and author, who talks about Project Blitz, a sophisticated operation he recently exposed that has written model legislation and is now pushing for the adoption of Christian nationalist-inspired laws in state legislatures across the U.S.
Well, I can't say I did it entirely myself. A friend happened to stumble across it and said, I better tell Fred about this, knowing that I've been doing work on religious freedom-related issues for a long time. And sure enough, you visit the website, and you can still find it there to this day, I think. There was a kind of buried in the website, a little hard to find, but it's there, hidden in plain sight, this 116-page strategy manual that offers 20 model bills about various aspects of the Christian right agenda, all under the rubric of religious freedom. So there's everything there from model bills that would allow or require schools to post In God We Trust in the public schools. Other things would have be resolutions that state legislatures could pass allowing honoring Religious Freedom Day. But the more serious kinds of things are model legislation that would seriously affect the civil rights, particularly of gay and lesbian people, by legalizing many of the things that were at issue in the Masterpiece Cake Shop decision the Supreme Court decided today. So if you were a business, that you would, as a matter of religious conscience, not have to serve gay people. There's also a bill that would allow religious institutions not to be involved in adoption or foster care services for same-sex couples. And it goes down the line in that way. So it's a very serious and very considered legislative package. And I say that because they've taken the time to study what's gone on around the country, seen what's worked and hasn't worked, and to seriously learn from what has been happening so that they can do better going forward. And it comes complete with talking points and the general vision of the legislative strategy and resources to back up the legislative proposals if they're made. So it's a really remarkable document, and I have to say in 30-plus years of doing research in this area, I've never seen anything like it.
Well, Fred, since you've written your article in late April, and it's gotten some publicity here in the U.S., in the U.S. press, not as much as it deserves, of course, but what's the response of some civil society groups who are certainly finding themselves on the opposite side of this Project Blitz Christian right agenda? And what, if anything, is percolating in terms of organizing opposition to this Christian nationalist agenda in state legislatures?
Well, we're at a very early stage, but I will say that groups like the Interfaith Alliance and Americans United for Separation of Church and State are very concerned about it and want to do something, as does the Religious Coalition for Reproductive Choice. My organization, Political Research Associates, organized a webinar a week or so ago with the Public Rights Private Conscience Project at the Columbia Law School and Americans United for Separation of Church and State, and got about 80 leaders to participate in that to begin to get a grounding of what this means, what's new and what's different here, and how should we begin to think about it. And I'll be involved in a similar kind of webinar on Wednesday, beginning to speak to LGBTQ activist groups involved in the states who are understandably interested and concerned and beginning to get their minds around it too. So I think we will be seeing state and national interest groups figuring it out. State legislative sessions are pretty much over for this year, but there's time to think about what to do for next year, and I think that's what we'll all be thinking about.
That was Frederick Clarkson, a senior fellow with Political Research Associates and author. Find a link to Clarkson's widely read recent article titled Project Blitz Seeks to Do for Christian Nationalism What ALEC Does for Big Business by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. students in the sixth grade class at Cold Spring School, an independent school in New Haven, Connecticut, spent a lot of time learning about the topic of sustainability this year. Each student wrote a paper and worked on a project that focused on an issue related to sustainability. One student, Sam Rosenberg, wrote a paper on climate change solutions and then organized a rally for climate action in a local park on May 31st. Sam connected with a local volunteer from the group 350 Connecticut, who provided some guidance. Then the sixth grader applied for and received a city permit, scheduled speakers, and planned the entire event. On the day of the rally, he was joined by classmates, who carried handmade posters urging action to address the climate crisis. Also attending the rally was Sam's teacher, some parents, and local climate activists. Before Sam spoke at his rally for our climate future, local activist Diane Lentakis, a volunteer with 350.org in the Connecticut chapter of the Sierra Club, talked about the club's Ready for 100 campaign, urging cities and towns to commit to transitioning to 100% clean and renewable energy sources by adopting policies to promote energy efficiency and utilizing wind, solar, and electrified transportation.
This is a national campaign that consists of people working together to inspire our decision makers to transition their towns and cities to be powered with 100% clean, renewable energy. This collaboration is asking mayors, CEOs, religious leaders, civic and community leaders, environmental organizations, environmental justice organizations, parents, and students, especially, to commit to solutions that help us achieve 100% clean, renewable energy. By 2035 or sooner for the electric sector, and by 2050 or sooner, and I emphasize or sooner, for the other sectors, transportation, heating and cooling sectors. This campaign is different from traditional grassroots campaigns in the following regard. The goal is to win substantive action-driven local clean energy victories as to execute national communications and movement-building strategies that will collectively shift the national public will to transition our energy sectors to 100% clean, renewable energy. Ready for 100 creates networks of local leaders who support each other in building a powerful, well-organized movement from the ground up. We have been using certain tools in this campaign, such as community mapping and power mapping, and it helps us identify, especially the community mapping, helps us identify the different organizations within the particular town and or city that we're working in to encourage them to work with us as a group and encourage the leaders to transition their towns and cities to 100%.
That was Diane Lentakis from Connecticut Sierra Club and 350 CT. Sixth grader Sam Rosenberg wrapped up the rally.
In humankind's history, we have made marvelous inventions. The plane, the car, electricity. The examples I just mentioned and others are in our daily lives so much we hardly notice or think about them. But if they have a negative effect on the environment, then they're all for the worst. When people take actions, they can have an effect on the environment. Depending on the action, this effect can be positive or negative. Almost any action you do has a carbon footprint. A carbon footprint is the amount of carbon dioxide we put into the atmosphere due to what we do or buy. And the effects of our actions have a huge impact. According to 97% of all scientists, our carbon footprints are causing more storms, more floods, and more droughts. They're causing mass migration, which can lead to conflict and human casualties. Shouldn't our actions cause the opposite?
Yes.
But why should we care about our effect on the environment? Why? Wouldn't the high-powered people take care of it? Should we even think about this? But it's not just their fight. Not just the United States fight. Not just Mexico's fight. Not just Canada's fight. Not just France's fight. Not just all the other countries' fight. It's our fight. As the entire world's fight. It is our responsibility to keep the environment healthy. It's our fight to think about our impact to the climate. It's our fight to do things that will lower our carbon footprints. It's our fight to let our representatives know how we feel. Statewide, countrywide, and worldwide. So this is where I bring my speech to the end. What does the future hold for our climate, for the planet, for us? Who knows? All I know is if we take care of the environment, the future will be for the best.
That was Sam Rosenberg, a sixth grade student at Cold Spring School in New Haven, Connecticut, who organized a climate rally at a local park on May 31st. The speaker preceding Sam was Diane Lantakis of 350CT and the Connecticut chapter of the Sierra Club. Learn more about youth organizing on climate change issues by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WZBC in Newton, Massachusetts, WPKN in Bridgeport, Connecticut, KOWA in Olympia, Washington, and more than 50 other community stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Richard Hill, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.